This Is Me, a podcast discussion, the causes and consequences of getting the Arab Spring wrong, a discussion, was recorded during the 5th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of the Middle East and Africa in Washington, D.C. on October 12, 2012.
Good afternoon. My name is Asaf Ramarowski. I'll be chairing this panel. A little bit of a tweak as far as the subject matter of today's panel, given the recent events that are happening in the region, that we thought would be more applicable to today's recent events. We're going to discuss the Islamists in power and how it relates to U.S. foreign policy today. Our panel of experts are experts in that area, and I think you'll find it very interesting. So without further ado, let me introduce today's panelists. First, we have Dr. Robert Satloff. Dr. Satloff has served as the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy since 1993. In this capacity, he oversees all the Institute's operations and leads the organization's unparalleled team of Middle East experts and policy practitioners. He also holds the Institute's Howard P. Berkowitz Chair in U.S. Middle East Policy. He's an expert on Arab and Islamic politics as well as U.S. Middle East policy. He has written widely and spoken on the Arab-Israeli peace process, the challenge of political Islam, and the need to revamp U.S. policy and diplomacy in the Middle East. Our next panelist is Lee Smith. Lee is a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. He's a fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the author of The Strong Horse, the title of his book, Power, Politics, and the Clash of the Arab Civilizations. Eric Traeger is our third panelist. Eric is the Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute. He's a PhD candidate at Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's focused on Egyptian opposition parties. He was in Egypt during the 2011 anti-Mubarak revolt, and his writings have appeared all over the place in publications like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, and others. I am Asaf Ramarowski. As I said before, I am currently the acting executive director of Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. I'm also an adjunct fellow at the Middle East Forum and the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. The format for today's panel is going to be that each of the panelists is going to have about 10 minutes to talk about their area of expertise. And then we're going to try to bring it back to Washington and see how it relates to Washington's outlook on the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, specifically as the Middle East is changing. I believe that Lee will talk about the environment of the Islamists, the rise of the Islamists in the area of Syria and Jordan, correct? And Eric's expertise will be is Egypt, and of course he will talk about what's been happening of late in Egypt, and specifically how it relates to U.S. foreign policy and the rise of the Musri government, and how we deal with Islamists in power. I'm sure that as part of the Q&A, and of course we'll get to that. There will be questions about the Israeli-Palestinian dynamic, that you know, how that relates at large to what's affecting and what's happening in Israel, and I'll ask a little bit about that as well. And Rob will bring it back to Washington as a Washington insider to kind of say how this has acted historically as far as the administrations and where we are today and how things are shifting in the Middle East and how that may or may not change U.S. foreign policy towards the Muslim Brotherhood as the major force in many of these countries that are changing. We're going to start with Eric, and then we're going to go to Lee, and then bring it back, and Rob will close up the panel.
So I just want to begin by thanking Asaf for that introduction, and thank you all for being here. What I want to lay out today is, first and foremost, kind of who the Muslim Brotherhood is, what it is, how it works, and why I think it will likely dominate politics in Egypt for a while, and why, frankly, it's very unlikely to moderate. So the key question I get a lot is, you know, how did the Muslim Brotherhood emerge from a pro-democratic revolt last year to become very quickly Egypt's next ruling party? I'm going to make a couple of points. First of all, I'm going to talk about the Brotherhood's committed membership. Secondly, I'm going to talk about the Brotherhood's strong nationwide structure. I'm going to lay that out on these slides. And third, I'm going to show the way in which the Brotherhood has very quickly moved to centralize its control over the bodies of government in which it's now in control of. So first off, you know, there's this perception that the Muslim Brotherhood will essentially govern like any other party. Yes, they have extreme rhetoric. They've said things against America, against Israel, against Christians, against women over the years. But once they're in power, things look very differently. They'll moderate. And what I would press you to think about is that the Muslim Brotherhood is not really like, first and foremost, any other political party. You know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or a Green Party member, you join that party typically by checking a box on a form at a DMV. Well, you know, Muslim Brothers didn't go to the DMV to join the organization. Typically, they're recruited from mosques or high schools or universities, and in the first stage after recruitment, they become what's called a muhib. Muhib essentially means fan. They are muhibs for 6 months to a year, and during this period, they're closely monitored by other Muslim Brothers as to their piety, as to their values. Do they pray five times a day? Can they work well with others within the organization? They're vetted. After they pass a written exam that typically tests them on areas of Islamic knowledge, they become what's called a mu'ayyid, or a supporter. This stage in the Brotherhood lasts 1 to 3 years. There's now a textual component to their studies. There's a curriculum. They're integrated into the Brotherhood structure, which I'll go over in the next slide. They then pass another exam after 1 to 3 years, and they're a muntasib. At this point, they're essentially members in pencil, so they can still be thrown out if it turns out that they're, you know, not good fits for the organization. They go deeper into the Brotherhood's curriculum, have to study more Quran, more tafsir. At this point, they start giving 6 to 8% of their income to the Brotherhood. After that, they take another exam, and they become a muntazim, an organizer. That lasts about 2 years. Again, deeper curriculum. They now have responsibilities within the organization for social services, for planning, for outreach, for preaching. Finally, after about a 5 to 8 year process, they become what's called an akh amal. What I'm laying out here is, again, a 5 to 8 year process during which prospective Muslim Brothers are vetted for a number of factors: how pious they are, how committed they are to the organization, and most importantly, whether they're willing to take orders from a centralized command. They are vetted for 5 to 8 years. Tells you why Muslim Brothers are generally loath to leave the organization, because you're not going to leave an organization you spent 5 to 8 years trying to join. And also tells you that those who are less committed, those who might moderate, are in fact weeded out during this process. So in other words, the kinds of people that become Muslim Brothers are really very different from the kinds of people that might join another party. This is not a big tent organization. This is an organization that's looking for a very specific kind of person, and if you're not it, you're out. They also have a strong nationwide structure. It is a very well integrated pyramid, at the bottom of which is something called the usra, or the family. This is about a 5 to 8 person unit. This is the most basic level of the Brotherhood's hierarchy. Muslim Brothers meet in their usra generally weekly for about 3 hours. They discuss text. They discuss politics, increasingly so since the revolution, based on my my interviews with Muslim Brothers. And this becomes, you know, kind of the key element of their social lives as Muslim Brothers. In other words, the people in the family become their best friends. Another reason why they're not going to leave the organization, because doing so would mean leaving their best friends. The Brotherhood has essentially integrated its members' social lives into the organization. I'm going to go through the rest of the structure rather quickly. 6 to 12 families makes up a populace. A number of populace makes up a muntaka, or an area. A number of those makes up the muhafaza, or the governorate. You then have a number of governorates makes up a sector. And then at the very top of this pyramid, this should be familiar to anyone who's read about the Brotherhood, you have the guidance office, Maktab al-Irshad. It's a 20-member body. It's the executive body of the Brotherhood, comprised of very senior members. And its legislative body, which I've put in yellow, I want you to remember this, is the Shura Committee. It's comprised of about 120 members, I think now 123. Basically, the way this works is that key strategic and political decisions are voted on in the Shura Committee. They are then passed up to the guidance office, which sends the command down this nationwide chain. This is, for example, how the Muslim Brotherhood moved so quickly during the revolution. As many of you know, they didn't endorse it on January 25th, 2011, when it started. They joined the night of the 27th, just ahead of the very pivotal Friday of Rage protests on January 28th. And remember, they did that in an environment where the internet had been shut down. There were no cell phones. How did they mobilize people? Because they have this structure. When it came time to form a political party, there was this myth out there that this political party was really just a political wing of the Brotherhood that would be institutionally separate. But I'm going to show you that's false, because in fact, the three leaders of the Freedom and Justice Party, which was formed in the spring of last year, were top guidance office members, right? Mohamed Morsi was the chairman, Issam El-Aryan the vice chairman, and Saad al-Khattani the secretary general. And this structure became very useful when the Brotherhood ultimately ran in the parliamentary elections, because they essentially picked their candidates through the structure. So if you wanted to run for parliament, you told the head of your usra, he approved it, let's say, passed it up to the Shoaiba level, it was judged against other files, up through the chain until the very top, at which point it was finally approved by the Freedom and Justice Party's executive committee, which again was comprised of former guidance office leaders. So again, what you have is a very tight nationwide structure that has now been I wouldn't say transformed, but adapted for a new political circumstance. What the Brotherhood has done since winning the parliamentary and presidential elections is moved very, very quickly to spread its top central leadership across the bodies of government it now controls. I'm going to lay that out right here. The myth that the Brotherhood will tell you, and they tell me when I interview them, is that the Guidance Office of Freedom and Justice Party, which of course won elections for the upper house, the Shura Council, lower house People's Assembly, and the Morsi presidency, these are three separate things. So you go to a guidance office member and you say, hey, you know, is Morsi going to keep the treaty with Israel? And they'll say, don't ask us, we're not the president. Well, there's one problem with that answer, which is that all of these three bodies overlap in that Shura committee, that internal legislative body, 120 members within the Brotherhood. I'm going to get very specific here. First of all guidance office members are members of that Shura committee, the most important of which are Khairat al-Shatir, Mahmoud Ezzat, Mahmoud Ghazlan, and Mahmoud Hussein. Within the Morsi presidency, the members of that internal Brotherhood Shura committee are Issam al-Haddad, Issam al-Aryan, and Mohi Hamed. These are three top advisors to Morsi. And then you actually have dozens of parliamentarians who are also members of the Shura committee, the most important of which are, of course, the former Speaker of the Parliament, Khattani, the Majority Leader, Ibrahim, and Parliamentary Leader, al-Husseini, who is now the governor of Kafr Sheikh. By the way, these are not the only types of overlaps. These two guys, these guys were both members of the Shura committee as well. These guys were both in the guidance office. These are former guidance office members. So they're connected to the central leadership of the organization through a number of means. There was one puzzle, though, in my research. This research, really, I did over this last summer, which was that the Speaker of the Shura Council, that's kind of the House of Lords of Egypt, is not a member of the Shura Committee. So I said to myself, all right, how did they let somebody in this position of authority who was not a member of that inner circle, that internal Shura Committee? Well, what did I learn about Speaker Ahmed Fahmy? Well, first of all, he was colleagues at the University of Zakazik with two of the top guidance office members. He was also a colleague and roommate of Mohamed Morsi's at the University of Zakazik. Oh, by the way, his son is married to Mohamed Morsi's daughter. And just to show you how kind of intermarried this organization is, Mahmoud Ghazlan is married to Khairat al-Shatir's sister. Mahmoud Ezzat is married to the daughter of former Supreme Guide Mehdi Akef. So this is, again, a very tightly structured organization that has moved very, very quickly to push its top most trusted members across the bodies of government and now controls. I'm going to tell you a story about that. This guy's name is Farid Ismail. He's a member of the Internal Shura Committee. He's also a top Brotherhood parliamentarian. I interviewed him this summer, and it was the day after Morsi called back the parliament, which was kind of Morsi's first major attempt against the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And just 2 days prior, you had that Shura Committee meeting at which, you know, members of the Morsi presidency, top parliamentary leaders, and top Brotherhood leaders were all present in the same room. And I said to this guy, hey, at that meeting of the Shura Committee, did you discuss that President Morsi was going to call back parliament? He said, no. I said, really? Well, my understanding is that top Morsi advisor Issam al-Haddad was in that room, and former Speaker Khattani was in that room. You're telling me you had all these people in the same room, you did not discuss that the president was about to call back parliament. He says, Speaker Khattani wasn't in the room. I said, really? This is a picture of me and Speaker Khattani from Saturday's meeting at the Shura Committee. Are you sure he wasn't there? That's a very rare moment in research. You really never get to do that. Just to wrap this all up, so what, right? Well, first and foremost, the Muslim Brotherhood is going to remain Egypt's most cohesive, best mobilized political force, right? I mean, they've vetted their members for their commitment to the cause, and they have basically a militia-like system for mobilizing them. Nobody else in Egypt has that. Secondly, they're unlikely to moderate. Why do I say that? Because the bottom line is, if they're not really challengeable domestically because of how well they mobilize, then what's to force them to change their tune? What is to force them to sacrifice something ideologically? Nothing. Remember, this is an organization that has tried to remove people that don't agree with its founding ideology. It is ideologically coherent and faces no reason to moderate. If anything, their best challenger is the Salafists, which would pull them to the right, not to the center. So I think moderation is highly unlikely, and I think it's going to especially affect them in foreign policy. Because especially if an administration is not willing to pressure them, not willing to put real conditions on aid that Egypt needs, they're not going to be pressed domestically to change their outlook on the global scene. And they're certainly not going to be challenged on the international level. That is, again, unless we do so. Fun facts from my summer research, just to wrap this up. Number three. And this will give you a sense of the question of moderation. Rifaat Mohammed Tahtawi was supposed to be their foreign minister, Morsi's foreign minister. He was, I believe, not allowed to be the foreign minister because of the pressure from the military. Now, this man, Tahtawi, was a former ambassador to Iran and Libya. He's very pro-Iranian, very opposed to the treaty with Israel, and he is now Morsi's chief of staff. Number two, three of the top Muslim brothers were recruited to the Brotherhood in the United States. This, for me, was shocking. Morsi, Muhammad Ali Bishr, who is now appointed a governor, I forget of which governor it, and Mahmoud Hussein, the Secretary General, and while they were university students in the United States being recruited, they were friends with Musa Abu Marzouk, Hamas's number two. And actually, Mahmoud Hussein told me that he used to hang out with Musa Abu Marzouk at these conferences during the late 70s and 80s. And the top fun fact is, Mohamed Morsi was Hamas's point of contact within the MB until he became president. Thank you.
Right. You're going to sit? Okay. All right. Lee will go next.
Thanks. Thank you, Asaf. Is this the Zahn? Thank you, Asaf. Thanks to Esme, and well done, Eric. Thanks. It was great. I'm just going to speak very briefly. I'm not actually going to describe so much the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. I just wanted to point to some different issues that are going on right now in Syria. The administration and a lot of analysts, a lot of people around the administration, and even those, many of those often opposed to the administration on the right, have noted that, look, if we wind up backing the Syrian uprising, we don't know who's going to wind up on top in Syria. And as a matter of fact, of course we know who's going to wind up on top of Syria. It's the people right now who are being backed by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, namely the Islamists, both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists. And I guess the first question I'd ask right away is, if the reason that they're going to come out on top is because they have the support of these three regional powers, or the fact that these three regional powers are supporting them in large part because they recognize that these are the actors these are the serious actors on the ground. These are the people with the highest level of commitment and the most seriousness. I'm going to direct you to an article 2 weeks ago in the Weekly Standard by a colleague named Jonathan Speier. And Jonathan spent about half a week in Aleppo recently with a number of different FSA, Free Syrian Army units. And he found them all interesting and decent people and serious fighters, and the, I guess for want of a better word, the secular units, that is the non-Islamist. Again, he thought they were serious people and courageous, and what they kept talking about was the desire to bring down Bashar al-Assad and to have an inclusive Syria that would also respect the rights of its minorities, which is a promising prospect. However, when Jonathan went and spent time with the Tawhid brigades, he recognized that this was a much more serious fighting unit. He actually didn't spend time with any of the Salafi units, but when he spent time with the Tawhid Brigade, which is, I think, alleged to be an MB unit, mostly backed by Qatar and Turkey, I believe, as well still, he recognized that this was one of the most serious units on the ground. And it wasn't just the fact that they had uniforms and they had more weapons, but they actually had a vision for what is going to happen in Syria after Assad falls, what that Syria should look like. It's not just a vague idea of a secular Syria, but a Syria that will have a real, that will have a strong Islamist core. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we see happening right now on the ground is Syria. We see some, in the different places where the regime has been pushed out, we see a lot of different committees establishing their own councils, establishing their own Sharia courts. So this is already happening on the ground as it is. As the regime recedes, especially from Sunni majority areas, this is what's being built up in its stead. So I guess the question that I want to come back to is, or the main question I want to ask is this an outcome that the United States has a stake in shaping in some way? I want to argue that it does. First of all, I want to point out that a lot of the people who have argued, and I think this is certainly an argument that we find coming from the right, and it's an argument that some people, I believe, have made on behalf of the administration's policy. Look, we have a vested interest in watching these two American adversaries, namely the Iranian-backed Assad troops, and also as well as different Iranian forces, as well as Hezbollah forces, fighting it out with al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. In some ways, it's an idea modeled on the Reagan administration's policy during the Iran-Iraq War. I think in some ways, though, you can look at the Iran-Iraq War as not necessarily being that advantageous for U.S. interests. Insofar as after the war, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the U.S. was forced to land troops. And after the war, Iran went back to trying to re-export the revolution, most notably in Lebanon. We see one of the problems already when the U.S. is out of the equation and when the U.S. lets the fight happen, whether it's actively promoting it or if it just lets it happen. We see the immediate problem right now in Turkey with the exchange of fire, across the border over the last week. Turkey's an extremely vulnerable American ally right now. In lots of ways, the administration has hung Erdogan, who is an ally, if a very difficult ally at times, has hung him out to dry in many different ways. The same may be happening in Jordan as well, and the administration has sent a small contingent of troops there in the event that something does happen. I think the U.S. has an active interest. I think the U.S. probably operates better since we're a status quo power. I think the U.S. operates better when we take an active role in something and help decide the outcome. Another problem is if it spreads to, I mean, it's also possible another place that it might spread to. Surprisingly, it hasn't spread that much to Lebanon so far over the last year and a half. But if it does spread to Lebanon, that turns into a problem not just for various Lebanese allies, but also for Israel as well, insofar as Hezbollah's default move is to heat things up on the border there. One of the important things to remember, I think another thing is that a lot of people have sort of forgotten what the Assad regime is about, the different problems that it's caused for the United States and our allies in terms of terrorism, in terms of building a secret nuclear facility. This is actually somewhat astonishing that people almost talk longingly now for the days of Assad as though when he falls, the Sunni regime that will follow it will be that much worse. I don't see how it can be that much worse. It was Assad who built the secret nuclear weapons facility, and it's Assad that's accumulated the chemical weapons stockpile. So this is the problem. And it will not be, insofar as people have said, that Assad respected Israeli red lines. He didn't respect Israeli red lines. Israel had to draw those red lines for Assad. Lots of times in the Middle East, and sometimes, unfortunately, even in places in Washington, people speak as though Assad had had been a de facto ally of both Israel and the United States. And this is nonsense. Most importantly, with the Assad regime, is that it's an ally of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I believe that the Islamic Republic is still the chief strategic threat that the United States faces. Historically, the United States has prioritized its different threats. In World War II, we took the side of Stalin and the Soviet Union to help defeat the Nazis. We wound up fighting an almost half-century-long Cold War with the Soviets, but I still think that siding with the Soviets against the Nazis was a pretty good deal. And I also think it was a good deal to back the Mujahideen to help hurt the Soviets in Afghanistan. I'm not sure why right now we seem to have forgotten these significant lessons from our past, that this is how we've typically operated in the world. We pick a side, we help that side win, and when that side turns out, if that side turns out to be a problem, we turn on that side as well, too. I just want to say one thing very quickly in summation. Again, I'm afraid I understand the concern, not just in Washington. If you'll notice, I mean, Rob can certainly speak to this much better than I can, but I believe that there's very little support with Republicans on the Hill as well for action in Syria. I think it's not just the Obama administration, and I think that people are looking at Syria. Understandably, the American electorate is tired of war. It's angry about its adventures in the Middle East. So this is certainly understandable. I think though that if you look at the way our regional strategy is laid out, the notion that Syria is going to end up as a conservative Sunni regime should probably not worry people as much as it does. And I say that looking at other problematic conservative Sunni regimes in the region that we're allied with, most notably the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which both domestically and in terms of how it projects power across the region, its soft power in terms of the kinds of Islam it promotes around the world, and its hard power in terms of the fact that it's often used, Al-Qaeda is one of its regional security pillars. Nonetheless, we seldom hesitate to call Saudi Arabia, as problematic as it is, an ally. So my argument is that I don't want to reduce it too much and say, yes, I'm coming out with a pro-Salafi, pro-Muslim Brotherhood argument. But yes, I think that the United States has prioritized its threats. I think the threat right now to the United States is the Islamic Republic and what it takes to bring that regime down, including supporting the people who are going to help bring that regime down and seeing how we shape the outcome. I think that's the proper course.
Rob?
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Asaf. It's a privilege to be on the panel with Eric and Lee. Eric, I just traveled around the Middle East with, and there really is no one who knows the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt better than Eric Traeger, and to have him as a colleague is a great privilege. And Lee is someone for whom I've had great respect for many, many years, author of an outstanding book on to understand the dynamics of the contemporary Middle East. And Lee, it's really wonderful to be on the panel with you. I'll just open up with a comment. This is complimentary, really, to Lee's closing comment about Syria. I phrase it in a slightly different way. I guess this is being taped and this is going out to the real world eventually, right? In my view, the U.S. policy towards Syria is inadvertently designed to bring about the absolute worst possible outcome. I'm sure that it takes a lot of effort to achieve this, but it is being done, I assume, quite inadvertently. And that is through our reluctance to engage in Syria. I believe there's a reasonable chance that we not only help engineer a jihadist outcome in Syria, but we may bring about the downfall of other allies in the region, such as the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, who, if it is caught between the hammer of Ikhwani Egypt and the anvil of jihadist Syria, is about as likely to survive, or is less likely to survive that than it survived Nasserite Egypt and Arab nationalist Syria 60 years ago, and it only barely and truly barely survived that experience. My suggestion in Syria is not unlike Lee's. We face the situation between bad and worse. There is no, in my view, good outcome in Syria. We passed the point of good outcomes by our inaction about a year ago. We face bad outcomes and worse outcomes. And frankly, that's a similar trope that we find, I think, in many places in the Middle East today. And good policymaking, it's not heroic policymaking. It's not Nobel Prize-winning policymaking, but good policymaking, in my view, is to try to limit the worst outcomes and, if not celebrate, that at least try to bring about the less bad policy outcomes. And in Syria, the less bad policy outcome is as quick as possible to bring about the demise of the Assad regime, prevent a millennium-long sectarian war, and probably see an Ikhwani dominated but not monopolized regime successor to the Assad regime. This is not a winning campaign slogan, bring the Ikhwanis to power in Syria. But given some of the alternatives in Syria, it is not as bad as some of the others that we face. Let me step back for a minute and make a few broader comments about how we look at, or how we do and how we ought to look at questions of Islamists in politics and Islamists in power. In a specialist's audience like this, one shouldn't have to define one's terms. But I find it, even in specialist audiences, it is useful at least to go over some of the groundwork very briefly. What is an Islamist? What is an Islamist political party? Because we have, for some people, this conjures up Muslim analogs of the Christian Democrats. That, of course, is not the case. Islamism is, and I will quote, in my view, an accurate definition, the pursuit of political power with the aim of establishing regimes based on Sharia law. I think there are key elements of that that you will find in all Islamist political parties. It's about power. It's about power. It's not about propagating the faith. It's not about dawah. It's not about expanding social services for the sake of expanding social services. It's ultimately about power. And it's ultimately about power with a goal. And the goal is the implementation of Sharia law as perceived by the group. And I think these elements are essential. I'll even quote someone not often quoted in this context, which is then National Security Advisor Tony Lake, who's currently the head of UNICEF, who said in a 1994 address, what distinguishes Islamic extremism, and I will say my view is it's what distinguishes Islamists in general, what distinguishes Islamic extremism from other forms of extremism is not terrorism, he said, but the naked pursuit of political power. And I think the same applies to Islamists. It's the pursuit of political power. If this is Islamism, then how do we relate this to what we think of as democracy, which is usually the litmus test for acceptability in terms of engagement by the US government? Well, I'll offer six attributes of democracy that I think we should all be able to agree on. One, the people are the source of legitimacy. Two, periodic elections to choose the people's representatives, resulting in periodic rotations of power. Implicit to this is the idea that a political minority can, through victory in the battle of ideas, become the political majority. Three, respect for certain rights, what President Obama likes to call universal rights, rights of speech, assembly, etc. Four, protection of religious minorities and ethnic minorities, protection that goes much further than just tolerance. And here, it's an important distinction. And lastly, the rule of law and respect for a judiciary that is independent from the swings of political power. Now, of course, the question is not asking whether Muslims can be good Democrats. The answer of that is an emphatic yes. But can Islamists be Democrats? Can advocates of the ideology of Islamism, while retaining fidelity to that ideology, lead their country to democracy? My answer is no. I think we have considerable experience in this. Iran, Gaza, Sudan, Lebanon, Turkey. And none of these countries have all the attributes I just listed, have all the attributes occurred when Islamists came to power. There have been no rotations of power in any of them. Rights are recognized only in some of them, and to varying degrees. In some of them, no free and open elections have occurred. In some, the people are not even recognized as sources of authority. Are Islamists necessarily terrorists? Absolutely not. Is violence a necessary component of Islamism? No. Can Islamists compete in elections to achieve political power? Sure. Can Islamists enter coalitions with non-Islamists? Yes. Have there been Islamists that renounced violence? Yes. When circumstances have compelled them so, or when they've been able to achieve political progress via other means. Will Islamists surrender power if they lose elections? We don't know. It hasn't happened. And we have no idea whether the first set of Egyptian elections in 7,000 years is really the last set of Egyptian elections. Some people like to take it for granted that Egypt now has entered the era of competitive democracy. Why they believe so definitively is beyond me. We certainly have no evidence. We have hope, but no evidence. Will Islamists necessarily fight to hold on to power? Well, that depends on the assessment of what the communists used to call the correlation of forces, a practical assessment of whether it is better to fight or to wait for another day. So the question, is there an Islamist path to democracy, is not the same as asking, is there a Christian path, a Christian democratic path to democracy? Rather, it's akin to asking, is there a communist path to democracy? The answer was no for communism. It's no for Islamism. There's lots of quotes I could refer to here. Ikhwan Online, the Muslim Brotherhood website in Egypt in 2005, before the Ikhwan learned the art of Western public relations, said the following, quote, if democracy means that people decide who leads them, then we accept it. If it means that people can change the laws of Allah and follow what they wish to follow, then it is not acceptable. And I think that's about the sum of it. And we have seen more recent than that, similar quotes across various Muslim majority countries. Erdogan's famous quote in Turkey, democracy is like a train. You can, you know, get off at the station. And just recently, there's a video circulating from my dear friend Rashid Ghannouchi, who promised the Salafists in Tunisia how they will use democracy to implement an Islamic state in what was thought to be the most secular of the Arab Spring regimes. So this is the relationship between Islam and democracy. Now let me put this in policy terms. How can and should we relate to Islamists as political parties? And how and can we should we relate to Islamists in government? Well, we have some experience with Islamists in political parties, and it's all over the map. And this applies to Republicans and Democrats alike. There's really been no uniform standard. We didn't speak to Hamas, mostly because of the conditions related to the peace process. We didn't speak to the Muslim Brotherhood before the Egyptian Revolution, but there we cited a different rationale, because the Brotherhood was technically not a legal political party in Mubarak's Egypt.
We did speak to other Ikhwan political parties. We spoke to the IAF in Jordan. We spoke to the PJD in Morocco. And we speak to various parties. But we have a very ad hoc, we traditionally have had, a very ad hoc set of guidelines governing our relationship with them. My humble suggestion is this, would be this, in countries in which there remains open competition. And it is very simple. The United States needs to be, in my view, interested not just in promoting democracy, but in promoting Democrats. There's a difference between the two. And we can do both at the same time. Promoting democracy is the idea of promoting the institutions that give rise to the sort of principles that I argued earlier. Promoting Democrats is to be discriminate, more discriminate, in our relationship with political parties and movements that can bring about that democratic endgame. We should not be blind and indifferent to the outcome of competitive elections in which there are parties and movements who are at least closer to achieving those democratic ideals than the Islamists. We should not try to create and sustain a level playing field. We should create the conditions for democratic development, and we should be willing to support through various means parties, movements, and leaders who are more likely to align themselves with our interests and values. I don't think we have anything to apologize for in pursuing a policy like that. The situation becomes more complicated when you have Islamists in power, such as we have in Egypt today. And let me just make a couple of brief comments about this, and then I'll close. There are, in general, three broad options as to how the U.S. government should deal with the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt today. On one hand, there are those, including some in the U.S. administration, who argue that it is an American interest to contribute urgently, aggressively, and generously to the success of the current Egyptian government. That this government represents a democratic government, and its successful transition and its successful weathering of the economic storm is manifestly in our interest. And they would, advocates of this position, would support virtually unconditional and quick disbursement of American aid and American support for Egyptians' requests at international financial institutions like the IMF. On the other end of the spectrum, there are those who say quite at the opposite. America has no interest in seeing the Muslim Brotherhood succeed. The Muslim Brotherhood is opposed to our interests and our values, which indeed is the case, and we should do all in our power to bring about their swift demise, which means the end of American assistance and preventing, by all means, their achievement of loans from the IMF and other international institutions. The repercussions here could be catastrophic, of course. Egypt, a country of 80-some-odd million people, could fall into failed state status, and not just the fragile state in which it is today, in which we would have, well, maybe not quite Somalia, but something approaching that on the borders of Israel and sitting astride the Nile and the Suez. I reject both these options. I think it's a mistake either to view the democratic experiment in Egypt as having been settled in favor of the Ikhwan, and therefore America eagerly supporting the success of the Muslim Brotherhood government, nor do I think it's wise for the United States at all to be viewed as or contribute to a failed state in Egypt. I think that would be a horrible outcome for our interests. Rather, it seems to me, this is precisely the moment when America needs to compel the government of Egypt through the use of the leverage of our own aid and our own access to international financial institutions to begin to make choices. That the government of Egypt, through our conditionality, he has to make decisions about whether indeed it is the Muslim Brotherhood government of Egypt or the state of Egypt, representing all of its people. Conditionality can be in the form concerning peace with Israel. It's important to note that President Morsi has not once, in his official capacity, uttered the word Israel. And if you scratch the surface among the Muslim Brotherhood leadership in Egypt, they retain their view of unreconstructed anti-Zionist, rejecting the Israel's legitimate right to exist. But it's not only Israel. It's also other interests that we have, for which we should, I believe, use our leverage to compel the Egyptians to take responsibility for security in Sinai, and to compel the Egyptians to make decisions about inclusiveness concerning their own religious minorities and women inside their country. Ultimately, we have a very powerful interest to ensure, as I said and when I began, that the first set of elections in Egypt are not the last set of elections in Egypt, and that we should use the leverage at our disposal to maintain the process of competitive democracy. And we should be continuing to reach out to the non-Islamists in Egypt, just at the same time as we have a relationship with the Islamists who run that country. We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you to all our panelists. Obviously, we have a lot of information here. Let me, as the moderator, let me take the prerogative of asking the first question, and then we'll open up the floor to as many questions people might have. All everybody has spoken about really the rise of Islamists to power and what that's doing to stability in the region on the heels of Rob's last comments right now. I mean, we're trying to differentiate between, you know, the less of two evils and trying to figure out, you know, what is happening between non-state actors who are taking roles, you know, within state actors and what it's doing to stability at large. And going to Eric's comments about the structure of the Brotherhood, of late we've heard Muhammad Badeh, who's come out with a clear statement about the fact that there should be a replacing negotiations with Israel with the holy jihad. I mean, these are obviously statements that are concerning, you know, the stability at large. My question is really, how do we, when we have, you know, when we're seeking partners in the region and we're trying to figure out who is the partner we're talking to vis-a-vis the people that are rational enough to discuss, while there is a extraordinary amount of pressure coming out of Washington to jumpstart the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, as well as deal with Iran, how do we balance that out? And how are we able to say, you know, leverage, you know, our allies in the region? We're trying to minimize the influence of these Islamists who are trying to garner power when, you know, like you said, Rob, you know, Morsi has yet to say the word Israel. You're seeing all this kind of rhetoric that's coming out. And so is there a way to kind of do more leveraging beyond the financials that we have? Are there people that we can, you know, press, you know, the screws a little bit tighter to get, you know, outcomes that we can deal with as far as stability in the region at large?
Sure. First, a prefatory comment, which I regrettably forgot to mention at the outset of my remarks, and that's to note the absence of a colleague whose research and whose analysis I think informs much of the work that I do, and that's Barry Rubin. Barry is a brilliant scholar, been so for many years. I'm very sorry that his illness prevents him from being here, but I did want very much to underscore Barry's enormous intellectual contribution, I think, to this organization specifically, but even more generally, to the to what I like to think is a realistic look at the Middle East, looking at it the way it is, not the way we'd like it to be. And that really goes to the heart of what you're asking, which is, you know, how can we try to realistically deal with this, with the region? I think there is a certain sense of humility which we need, which is that we cannot fashion the domestic politics of these countries in our image. We cannot make them all into little Americas. And if we ever thought we could, the events of the last 18 months should have dispelled that completely. But we do have interests. And these countries, these leaders want things from us. And in a transactional way, We should be able to use our leverage to compel certain decisions and behaviors, even from leaders with whom we have very different worldviews. And we should not, in my view, be reluctant in a respectful manner to use that leverage to help achieve certain policy outcomes. And with Egypt, they, as I said, they include maintenance of peace with Israel, concerted effort against jihadists in Sinai, and maintenance of a certain level of civic discourse regarding religious minorities, women, and the likelihood of further democratic elections.
I've been wondering, with the aid package to Egypt now, and that, you know, before it served a different purpose. So what, I mean, what are the different ways in which we can use it now to our advantage, if any? Or as Morsi just said, no, the army's mine, the money still comes in the way it comes, and this is how it's going to go. Are there different ways we can, you know, shape that?
I mean, you know, even despite all of the domestic political changes that have happened in Egypt over the last 18 to 20 months, our interests in Egypt actually remain largely the same. That includes, you know, protecting the treaty with Israel, strategic cooperation, overflights, rights in the Suez Canal, minority rights, having some sort of more open political process. I mean, those things don't change with the fall of Mubarak. If anything, what's changed over the last 20 months is that Egypt needs us more than they previously did because of the depths of their economic problems. I think that the economic aid is in particular a useful tool, not only the economic aid, but our influence, and I think Rob alluded to this, in our influence in major financial and economic institutions. But not only that, I think what's important to communicate to the Brotherhood is that at the end of the day, you know, we'd really like to have Egypt as a good ally, but they kind of need the United States as an ally. And they need the United States because they're going to be judged on their ability to provide for their people. And, you know, I'd just like to tell a little anecdote about this. Back in December, I was speaking with a very senior member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we were talking about the peace treaty with Israel. And at this time, the Muslim Brotherhood was making waves about possibly putting the peace treaty to a referendum. And I said to him at the end of the interview, I said, you know, when you talk about putting the peace treaty to a referendum, you're doing something very dangerous. He says, why? I said, because you're signaling you want to end the treaty that prevented war between you and a much stronger country to your northeast for the last 30 years. And he said, well, you know, that's democracy. I said, no. Democracy is electing you. What you decide to do is what you decide to do. You're going to put your tax policy to a referendum? He said, that's different. I said, why is that different? People pay about 25% of their income to taxes. You think they care more about a peace treaty? They don't feel any day of the week to taxes? So he started ranting about how, you know, he views the treaty as an imposition and the Israelis and Palestinians, etc. And I said to him, listen, you and I can agree to disagree on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but we should not disagree on the importance of keeping a treaty that prevented war between you and Israel for the past 30 years. And let me ask you something. Do you want Egyptians to die? He said, no. I said, then you'll keep the treaty. And I said, not only that, and if you don't keep the treaty, I'll be 6,000 miles away. It'll be you on the line. And that's kind of the message we have to send, that we care about this. We care about it a lot. But at the end of the day, Egyptians are going to be the ones that will feel the burden of the Brotherhood's bad decisions, that we're here as a friend to prevent them from making those decisions, and that should be the message. Thanks.
Since our time is up, I'd like to thank all our panelists for a very engaging and a very important debate, and I thank you all for showing up today. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To become an ASMIA member or to learn more about ASMIA, please visit us online at asmiascholars.org. That's ASMEA scholars.org.